podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the Don't Nearly View system, Diogo. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
It's Tour Live. It's Neil Atkinson joined by Andy McCann, by Stu Wright, by Steve Evans for something that might be filled with Kafkaesque bleakness. We are talking about Liverpool falling to a 1-0 defeat away to an energy-depleted Leicester City. We will look ahead to the game against Chelsea a little bit. We won't do loads on it because they haven't even played their game against Brighton yet, so it's difficult to envisage precisely what Chelsea were dealing with. Simultaneously, Manchester City will be turning up to Brentford with a massive spring in their steps, given the fact that they're only likely challengers for the Premier League title this season of drop points. We'll talk about where that title challenge is as well, whether or not it is indeed in ribbons at my feet, or whether or not there is more to come from the mighty boys in red. Can they turn it around from this point? Also on the show, Tour Live, if you're listening as a podcast, we have some excellent inserts. We've got Adam Rowe on his 2020, on him doing live at the Apollo, and his upcoming tour. That is all to come as well. So we've got the comedian Adam Rowe, and we've got the comedian Rob Gutman on 10 years of the Anfield Wrap. That is to come to. What more can you ask for from a piece of live podcasting about Liverpool Football Club? Stu Wright, it was going to be hard to win this league. It now looks like it's going to be a great deal harder. There's been points dropped from winning positions this year. But if you'd have said to me, as Mohamed Salah was about to step up and take that penalty, Liverpool aren't going to win this today, I'd have thought you were an absolute head case. It feels like points dropped from a winning position. It doesn't feel like 3 points dropped. It feels like 350 points dropped.
Yeah, I think that's the nature of the competition now, isn't it? You can't afford ever to lose. You know, you've got to win every game. That's the way it feels in this climate that City have co-created along with ourselves. I don't like City getting all the credit for that. But I think, you know, you just can't afford an off night, and too many of them had a massive off night. I don't think it was for want of trying in some cases. I've heard, you know, on various outlets, the Mane and Salah get it in the neck. And the thing is, with their performance, I thought they kept showing. They kept showing and showing and showing. They just didn't have the output. You know, they just didn't have that end product that they normally have. But I think there are individuals in the team who you can look at quite clearly from the performance and say, you weren't at your level. And maybe that's something that happens more often than we realise sometimes, because we've got a number of players who can win a game single-handedly. You know, if Mane sticks that in the net and we come away with a 1-0, if Salah scores the penalty, we come away with a 2-0, are we digging out the midfield like we potentially are going to? Are we looking at one or two in the defence like Trent, who, again, wasn't at his level? Are we looking at the keeper so much? I don't know. But I think you know, when your key players haven't got the output, when they can't provide you with the life-saving goal, then everyone in the team needs to be digging in, and I just didn't see that last night.
What I think is an excellent point is that what often happens with this Liverpool side, or has happened with this Liverpool side, is that one or two of them are able to pull the rest up. And the one or two of them can change. You know, sometimes it'll come from the base of the midfield in Fabinho and Thiago. Sometimes it might come from the midfield runners. It might come from Henderson and Trent down the right-hand side. Often this season, it's obviously been the top scorer in the country, who's part of why we are at the party in the first place. And it's worth remembering that. There's been moments where absolutely all of them have pulled the rest of them along, and then everyone's gone up a level and suddenly Liverpool are back and working. I thought what you saw last night is literally no one did that and the opposite happened. Everything just collapsed in on itself. The fine for the first 15 minutes, they're not great, don't get me wrong, but they're fine for the first 15 minutes. And I would say that performance for every 10 minutes that followed after 15 minutes degraded over and over.
Yeah, I could see the confidence just kind of getting sucked out with every sort of failed attack, really. Mo, Tenney didn't have a great game, neither did anyone else. Mane frustrating the life out of me again. And these things that they keep trying, you know, they huffed and puffed. You can't fault them for effort, but just the end product or the final pass or the finish from obviously even the penalty from Mo or the chance that Manny created and should have scored from just before Leicester scored, kind of typified the night for us really. Loads of endeavour, loads of effort, but just not really getting anywhere or creating anything. I don't think the substitutions helped as the game went on. They probably made it a bit more difficult for them. Every time a new player come on, but the shape going even madder or different. And then there seems to be too many players in the same areas, really, which again, you know, made it difficult for us to create anything solid. So it was a really frustrating night at the office for everyone, really. You know, I think we turned up expecting them to tie in the second half and to create more chances. But you know, one fact we did do is give them more hope and give them more encouragement of that they could get something from the game and get 3 points because by us being pretty poor in that final third.
Andy, the idea of giving them belief is the thing in the game that I found hardest. Watching it at the time, in hindsight, Liverpool could not give Leicester more encouragement in every single phase that a Steve's hit on there. You know, I think that I think before kickoff, those Leicester players might have just taken getting beat 2-0. After he misses the penalty, they begin to think, hang on, we could be in this. Then every 10 minutes again, they felt a little bit more like, hang on, we've survived another 10 here. And the idea of giving your opposition more and more to believe in over the course of a football match is, it's tough to take, and it's tough to take in the context of this title race.
Yeah, Gerrard got interviewed, didn't he, after the Villa game at Anfield, and he came out and explicitly just said, I told them to stay in it, hang on as long as you can, try and be 0-0, 1-0 down, 65, and then if there's anything to play for, we'll do it. And he was dead open and honest, saying, you know, there's a chance you get to 60 and Liverpool are out of sight. He said, but with the difference, and I think Leicester done that last night, and it felt weird for me. Like, first 15, I thought it had a feeling of inevitability, like we were going to... Trent was going to do one of them little diags in the box. It was going to be a flick. And then once the penalty happens, you're like, yeah, this is it, 1-0. And then I thought it could have gone on to be 3 or 4 before half-time. It could have had a feel of Man United. But it just started creeping in. And you know, one of the, certainly on the telly, Neil, I know you went, I think the others watched it. It became a bit like jovial on the telly. Like Henderson had them 3 volleys. And McCoister is brilliant and by a mile, my favourite co-commentator. It was almost like, you've probably not seen it, Neil, but he was like rating them out of 10, like you wouldn't, you know, for like a Strictly Come Dancing or something. And it became like a joke, but because you got sucked into that, you thought, oh, it's all going to be all right. But then near the end of the first half, Vardy has probably the biggest chance of the whole game based on the XG stuff I've looked at this morning. And obviously Matip blocks it. But then, before we come on air, I said, for me, the biggest thing was on 55, I think Rodgers is looking, going, they've started well for second half. The Mane miss completely changes everything in the game. I think it means it's 0-0. He makes a double change a minute after it. I know we bring Keita on, which I thought was a strange substitution anyway. But he brings 2 more attacking players on right after that. And that's when I think he thought, right, we're on 55 here and we've got a chance to get something out of this. And I'm not sure Tielemans made much of a difference. Certainly initially he was poor when he came on. He looked like a different player. But obviously Luckman comes on and makes a massive difference. You know, his only real one major influence on the game and he scores it. But yeah, I think that, as you said, the 10-minute thing was a good analogy. Every 10 minutes they grew into the game more. But I think the Mane miss was the deciding point.
I think, Steve, you know, we've all been dreadful footballers in different ways, so let's be clear about this, but we've all played in football matches where you do think, at some point you think, hang on, they just keep missing. We're in this, and in a way that we maybe don't even deserve to be. They just keep missing. We'll get something out of this, and that it just had a big sense of that to me all the way through the game. I think, you know, I completely agree with Andy with the idea of the immediate aftermath of the Mane miss. But I just thought that they suddenly start to think to themselves, Leicester, all the way through, they're letting us have this here. They're letting us have this one, and for me, it's that as I keep saying it, you know, it hurts so much to say it. It hurts to have let a team off the hook. It hurts to have let them off the hook. They, you know, there's another universe there where, as Andy says, it's 3-0, 4-0 to Liverpool, maybe even by half time. And we all feel very, very, very different today.
Yeah, it's true. But then, you know, it's, it's a lot of ifs and buts, and you've got to be ruthless in these situations. And for me, that's been a bit of a theme all throughout the season in them killer situations when we've had times to put games to bed. You know, we haven't, and there's been some of them games that we've won. Obviously, look at the Villa game at home, for example. So many chances to put the game to bed, and we just don't do it. You know, the ruthlessness that this side has shown over the past 3 or 4 years to get us to the level that we are just hasn't quite been there for me at times this season when it should be. And eventually, if you're not as ruthless as you should be and you miss these chances, you know, odds are you're going to get punished. You could see straight away from the penalty miss last night, the tails were up, the crowd were up, give them all the encouragement they needed. And as I said before, every sort of failed attack that we had in the second half, we looked a little bit more clueless, and then Lassadio misses his chance. And we lose our shape, and it's poor defending by Henderson and by Trent, to be honest with you. But keeper doesn't cut himself in glory, and then
don't think I have the centre halves, do I? Have stick. No, you know what I mean? You end up with almost like it's one of them where I feel like half the team, five players, are at the scene of the crime of that goal.
Yeah,
and it, you know, it's to be spread amongst all of them, and you're just thinking to yourself, Christ, that's not a good place to be.
Mm. Yeah, and again, I think the chance comes from a ball being played into feet up front, which doesn't stick. So you know, the failure is linked across the whole team, which again it was last night. So our reaction to these big chances being missed wasn't great last night, and as you said, there's all the encouragement that Leicester needed to grow into the game, and they look stronger as the minutes tick by. We were never going to get one, I don't think.
Stu, on the subs, which is, you know, it's interesting to me. I thought both Milner and Keita in the League Cup game come on and they make a massive difference. Like they hugely changed the game positively from Liverpool's point of view, especially Keita. I thought for the first 10 after Keita came on, it was like he'd not played footy before. It was stunning, to be honest with you. Milner's not that much better. I think Milner settles into the game. He gets a bit of an anchor into the game as it wears on a tiny little bit. Keita, again, I think he just begins to find himself. But when Liverpool needed subs to come and change the game, to me, it all felt a little programmed, felt like it was all done on sports science. As part of Liverpool, I think we're just expecting the game to come through to them, the game just to find its way through to them, the result to come their way. You know, I don't know what he'd have done differently if the game state was different, is my sort of point, with the exception of the Firmino sub.
Yeah, I think it's fair as well to give them a little bit of accountability for that, for the lack of impact they had when they come on. But I think there's some context as well. You know, Liverpool had no control over the game. In fact, Liverpool, when he made those substitutions, Liverpool completely changed the shape to a shape that they're unfamiliar with. I mean, it's a shape that Keita's familiar with. It's one he was successful with in a 4-2-3-1 over in when he was in Germany. So the manager knows that, you know, he can do a job there. But Liverpool just didn't have the platform to be able to build a sense of wave after wave after wave of attack, which is very much what we needed at that moment in time. So I think the substitutions, as you say, they really counted against the manager, really. They just had a negative impact on the game. But when you look at what was available on the bench, it was a paucity of options, really, for the nature of change that I think that we needed within that game. I mean, if there was ever a game that you're crying out for Thiago, it was that one. You needed someone desperately to be able to control that midfield, put your foot on the ball and dictate the play and actually just, you know, put a flag down and say, we're going to actually mount attack after attack from this position. But, you know, the option wasn't there, unfortunately, so.
What they do, Stu, and I think it's in part because of the nature of the game as it was, I couldn't believe how much we had the ball in their penalty area. Like in high, I think it's crazy how much we have the ball in their penalty area.
It's the most touches, you know, Neil, I think there's ever been in the Premier League in a penalty area in a game.
Without a goal or just full stop?
I think full stop.
Well, it was 38 in the first half, wasn't it, or something?
And I think that this almost becomes a bit of a weird sort of problem for Liverpool. And I think it's purely accidental. I don't think it's anything that's tactically brilliant. But it suits those two centre-halves who aren't centre-halves, who are centre-mids, that they're getting the game brought. They're not getting done with movement because there's nowhere to do movement. For me, one of the better chances of the match, in hindsight, is the Henderson header that he doesn't quite connect with, where if he just gets any more on that, he diverts it past Schmeichel. But that's from a run from deep where they've got centre-halves who aren't centre-halves, so no one anticipates it, no one sees it, and no one goes with it. What we were doing was we were just bringing the ball to them. Stu, yeah, in a really weird way. And we were letting them do the blocks, the tackles, all the stuff that you give each other a high five, you feel good about. And it's a really weird thing to think that, you know, almost because it was so easy for us to get into the penalty area in a really weird way. I think that's one of the, it was almost like rope-a-dope, but as I say, I don't think it's deliberate. You don't let a team like Liverpool be in your penalty area that much if you can help it. But Liverpool almost, they almost played themselves out of being good in their box because they thought, well, we'll just get back in a minute. We'll get another go.
Yeah, two things on that. First of all, I mean, I think that the way home for teams against Liverpool, if they are going to try and mount a defensive assault, if you like, if they are going to try and camp, then it's been shown over the years that the teams who clog up the middle have the most successful chance. So whether that's you playing three centre halves or you're playing three deep line midfielders just in front of them, you know, whatever floats your boat, I suppose. But, you know, clogging Liverpool up in those central areas is a way home. But also, I heard, I don't know if it was on the commentary itself or it was on social media. I mean, my mind's mixed it all up now from last night. But I heard a lot of people saying that Liverpool needed more composure. Well, I think the opposite is true. I think that's a complete load of tosh. In the box, the last thing Liverpool needed was more composure. The last thing Liverpool needed was more touches on the ball. Liverpool needed to move the ball quicker. Liverpool needed to stretch their defence and get them thinking. Every time we enter into their box, yeah, we might take a few extra touches and try and work an angle, but by which time their defence was set, everyone was back in the middle, bodies were everywhere. And that's the way home against Liverpool. You need a little bit of luck. In fact, you need a large slice of luck against Liverpool to get away with it. But it's your best way home. And, you know, they had the luck. We didn't. But I would certainly like us to see us in those situations being brave and moving the ball quicker, taking more risks to try and create those opportunities and unsettle a back four. Stop giving them time, you know, to set themselves.
Stop giving them time. It's one, Andy, where, as I say, the league table's grim reading now. You know, I felt as though last night, you know, in a number of different ways, I thought there was just this little thing where, as I say, they needed to win. They felt that the game was just going to come their way. They were allowing it to sort of to ebb in, to it working their way. I felt Chamberlain was too conservative in the middle of the park. I think he was trying to play a little bit like Wijnaldum, rather than just being more sort of grab the game by the scruff of the neck and see what you can do with it. But I'm sure that they'll, in a sense, Liverpool will have been relatively happy with that. But that's sort of what I mean. I think Liverpool felt as though if we just keep these pens in, given the nature of where they are for their fitness and their selection, eventually something comes. And that, I just prefer Liverpool when they're trying to make it happen. And that to me is the, you know, I think that ebbs away. I think that's there. They missed the pen. And then it's no longer like they're trying to make it happen.
Yeah, I think Leicester reminded me a bit of us back in the last season with two midfielders playing centre-half. They very much wanted just to be sat in and go, okay, well, everything's in front of us. You know, and I think indeed he's made something like 9 tackles and 7 interceptions or something across the course of the game. But there was never a point where we broke on them from halfway where we're so clinical and we've got, you know, 4 runners and Trent feeding the ball in. And it just looked very much like a game of, you know, I'm sure we've all been involved and watched them attack the defence in training. And when you've got 9 lads, you know, Vardy sat up front waiting for anything that comes loose, and then 9 of them just sat there going, go on then. We've got, because they've got a good keeper, to be fair to them. You know, he's kept them in it, made 3-4 really big saves. It just kind of took everything away from us, but we've got to be much better in the round of penalty. One thing that kind of hasn't come out, and a few people have made comment, I thought Henderson looked fucking way off it last night. Like I love him to death, you know what I mean? We just bought our Joe a new kit with his name on, and he's, you know, very much like, it's not me digging him out for digging him out sake here. I just thought he looked a mile off it after 10, 15 minutes, but it never got commented on. I thought Chamberlain was unlucky to come off for him.
I agree.
For Keita, I would have done Henderson. There was a point in the first half where he was off the pace, and I was looking, thinking, something's not right with him. And because his levels are so high normally, and, you know, as people who watch him a lot, we see what he does for the team. He just wasn't giving us anything last night. And I'm hoping, you know, it's not a dip in form. I'm hoping he was ill or something, and he just put it because Thiago was out. They risked him a bit, and it'll come out. You know, he might miss a game, but yeah, I thought Henderson was the biggest one not on his game last night, which then filtered through to the others because he is such a driving force within the team.
It's another one where you end up feeling like Liverpool have had a form of hard line, Steve, in that they could have scored the penalty. It could have been a little bit different. What happens after Leicester go 1-0 up? That's totally down to Liverpool. You know what I mean? Liverpool probably, at the point Leicester go 1-0 up, Liverpool do deserve to be ahead in the game. From the point Leicester are 1-0 up, Liverpool don't deserve a thing out of it. You know, football's not as binary as you either deserve something or you don't. But my problem with this is there's too many where I feel as though Liverpool have got mitigating circumstances. Brighton, you know, it could have been 3-0. It turned into 2-1. They throw the lead away. West Ham, they have hard lines with the referee early in the game. Think, you know, it is a foul as far as I'm concerned, but they don't really recover from it. Haven't got the game back to one each. They go on and lose the game. Tottenham, whether they deserve to be or not, they got themselves 2-1 ahead. They didn't see that one out. You'd end up going through this list of games this season. Even the two games against Chelsea and City, you know, Chelsea, it's 10 men. City, they take the lead twice. This is what concerns me is you can lose a league because of mitigating circumstances. You can lose a league because of hard lines. And I'm sat here today just concerned that come the end of the season, there'll be two or three sides that'll feel like they've got some hard luck stories in this league. But ultimately, at the minute, you get what you deserve, and City deserve to be 6 points clear of Liverpool.
Yeah, again, it comes back to the points I made before about the ruthlessness. You know, you think Manchester City side playing that Leicester team last night would have come away with nothing? I very much doubt.
You'd have scored a goal.
100%. You know, we've that's well just my point this season. I just don't think we've ever quite hit a couple of times Watford away and a few other performances we played really well, but the consistent level of the high performance we show when we won the league, when we were ruthless enough to go and just dominate games and we could see games out and we weren't conceding hardly any goals, no stupid goals anyway. It's just not there for me as much this season. That's not me saying that it's, you know, I'm conceding the title at the moment, but it's unless things change radically at both ends of the pitch, we're more ruthless in front of goal and we stop conceding such sloppy gift goals, which we seem to do so easy this season again. Then it's really going to make it hard for ourselves. You know, a foot on the throat of a game is going to be easy to do it if the likes of Mane and Salah just maybe stop overthinking things a little bit. I thought that was the case last night, and with both of them, I thought rather than act on instinct, I thought Sadio Mane now is literally overthinking things a little bit too much and trying to force things, and instead of it happening naturally for him. The same for Mo a little bit last night as well. I thought that was, you know, really tough. Is there, but trying to force the game and trying to force chances. I mean, especially the last 10 minutes, we'll be getting balls into feet at the edge of the box and Manny was spinning off. We should have been doing that from the start of the second half. I mean, it just took us going goal down with 5 minutes to go to start playing decent balls in and around the box.
Stu, you look at the results this season and there's two games Liverpool have won by a solitary goal. And you sort of think back to the 1920 season when I think there was a run where we won 8 or 9 by a solitary goal. You look at the games where they've dropped points. If you want to just write off the City and Chelsea draws, I don't. I still think they're a valid conversational point. But even there, you've got the game against Spurs, you've got the game against West Ham, you've got the game now against Leicester, you've got the game against Brighton and Hove Albion, and you've got the game against Brentford. And in all of them, Liverpool have ample opportunities to win those games by at least a single goal. And that is my overriding concern with this side, isn't how it's going to play when it's playing ever so well. It isn't even how it's going to play when it's playing genuinely badly. It's how it's going to just march its way through, sashay its way through a game when things are all a little bit in the balance and it's just going to find a way. Against Wolves and Villa, it looked like they had that knack. But now in these two away games, Tottenham and Leicester, that knack, to me, feels up for grabs.
I think it might be dangerous for us to give in to the temptation to compare ourselves to 1920 all the time.
Very fair, because it was an incredible team that did an unbelievable thing.
It was, and if anything, you know, you look at the personnel and this team might be on paper better, but actually, you know, there's moments in time, isn't there? And that moment in time may well have been the peak for this team. It certainly may well have been when they were at their most efficient best. We're not as efficient as we used to be. I also think that there's still things that they're trying to work out. The balance of the midfield has chopped and changed a little bit, and it's a little bit different in its nature now that Genie's gone, but also the expected output from them is a little bit more than I think the functionality of the way it was in previous seasons. And obviously we've had a significant change over up front with Jota, who's performing really well, but at the same time, you know, there's a different combination there for the midfield to link into than Firmino. You've got Virgil come back, and you know, he's found his way back to hopefully his very best very soon. But we're just not quite the same. And there's also a human factor, Neil. You know, the hunger. And listen, if you asked any of that squad if they were hungry for the title, of course they'd say yes, and I'm sure they think they are, and I'm sure they really are. But actually, comparatively to a time 1920 when they had just missed out the year before, they were riding the crest of a wave, having won the Champions League and the World Cup Championship. You know, it felt like that momentum was with them. Doesn't quite feel like the same momentum is carrying them forward this season, and I think they feel that too. It just feels a little bit more of a battle, and despite that, they're still in the mix, and I think they'll be in the mix all the way through. But there's no doubt now that we are looking at City and saying we're not quite there with them at the moment. We're not quite at that level. But there will be times, and there have been times earlier on this season, that City have looked at us and gone, we're not sure we're quite at that level. When we've gone to Old Trafford and smashed them 5-0, you know, I'm sure City were looking at us in quite the same way. So it feels at the moment that we're in a bit of a trough, and it's going to be a scramble to try and get to the peak again. But, you know, it's probably a little bit too early to get carried away with it at this stage.
More on that in a minute. Coming up, we've got Adam Rowe and we've got Rob Gutman. Both of those to come. This is Tor Live. It is an absolute pleasure to be with you, even if the result against Leicester most definitely was not in any way, shape or form, or indeed the entire experience, pleasurable. It is fair to say. We'll be back in a second after we've got Adam and we've got Rob.
And it is John Gibbons for Tor Live, and delighted to be joined over Zoom by Adam Rowe. And Adam, I had a look when you last came on. It felt like about 6 months ago. It was actually 18 months ago. It was last summer when lockdown had just started, which is mad. I've just got no concept of time at all. But around then, you were obviously, your comedy career was going well. Then we got into lockdown, you're figuring out ways, you've done some stuff, you know, that you're putting up gigs online, you're basically just trying your best. And I think, you know, from there, the fact that, you know, we've never really sort of come out of it, you must be so pleased with how it's gone for you. I'd say you've locked down very well, considering your job is making people laugh in rooms.
Yeah, it's really hard to sort of come to terms with the fact that a global pandemic has benefited my life.
You and Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, it's just me and Jeff that are roses. Like, it's such a weird thought. I think the last time I came on, I was promoting a comedy special I was putting out on YouTube called Club Comic.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I've put anything online that was like, is a full chunk. I've put loads of little clips on, but this was like a 45-minute stand-up special shot in London. And that did really well. The podcast I do, Have a Word, has gone from strength to strength. And as we've come out of these lockdowns, and we've done a couple of live shows with that. Yeah, and I've just got to do some really cool and bigger gigs over the past 18 months. And it set us up for next year to be the biggest year of my career so far. So yeah, it's been very exciting and very interesting, but obviously there's still the anxieties of if Boris Johnson and his mates do anything wrong and he decide they need to distract us and lock the country down, I could lose 2 months of tour dates.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird situation to be in, but overall, yeah, I've had quite a good year career-wise, I suppose.
Well, let's start with the pod then. You mentioned they have a word. Obviously, you know, as I say, it's been going for a while now, but over the last year sort of really exploded. You know, I'm always made up when the clips come on my timeline, when the new episodes are out, because I know it's just going to make me laugh. And I think for a lot of people, I assume it's a bit of forget about everything else and these lads are going to make me laugh for a bit, really. And you're not the only person trying to do that. So you're obviously sort of very, very good at it and things like that, because there's, you know, there's lots and lots of pods out there trying to do the same thing. But for some reason, you must get messages a lot. But basically what I'm saying really is that when I'm listening to yous and you just, you know, spitting together, you're having a laugh, you're taking the piss out of each other a little bit, like you do just forget about everything else for that little bit.
Yeah, so when we started the podcast January 2020, so it was just before the pandemic kicked off, and a lot of comedians, like if you meet with BBC producers or anything now, they're all like, oh, you need a niche, you need to be, for a podcast to take off, it needs to be a comedy one about murders, or it needs to be a comedy one about history or something. And me and Dan sat down and we're like, if I can make you laugh and you can make me laugh as two heavyweight headline comedians in the UK, the people at home are going to be crying their eyes out laughing. If we're laughing at each other, people at home. So let's start getting a niche. We don't need that. Let's just try and be the funniest podcast. Do say whatever it takes to get the laugh. And yeah, that's where the format came from. And now, I'll be honest with you, we do get quite a lot of messages going, and a lot of them are really nice, and a lot of them are like, oh, you've been a welcome distraction, really appreciate it, keep it up, and it's very short like that. And then we started getting some, which were like, really quite dark, not nasty, still nice, but like, I've been struggling so bad with my mental health, basically I've been on the brink, and just knowing that there's a Have a Word episode coming the next day has kept me going. And that, I'll be totally honest with you, yeah, scared the living shit out of me, because I was like, what if we miss one?
Yeah, can't stop now. Doing this forever.
It gives us such a burden of responsibility that, to be honest with you, it spun me head west. Obviously, it's phenomenal to know that if people are struggling, that a bit of light relief in our ridiculous senses of humour can provide any sort of light in the dark for them. But yeah, it was quite heavy for a period of time there where we were like, there's so many people, so many more people listening to this than we actually can comprehend.
Yeah, when it's just, as I say, the two of you making each other laugh in a room.
In a cupboard in Runcorn. it's impossible to wrap your head around, and you know the exact same thing from the Anfield back. Yeah. Thousands and thousands and thousands of listeners, but when you boil down to it, it's me and you sat on Zoom now, or it's you and the other lads from the rap, like, yeah, sat in the boozer after the pub or after the match. Like, we're in a little cupboard that we've turned into a studio in Runcorn, and there's four of us in the room, and when you record, that's all that's going on.
Yeah,
there's 100,000 people at home who are waiting on your every word. It's a mad thing to get your head around.
It is, and it feels like you've really built a community as well. And there's a lot of podcasts say that, but I feel like with yours, you know, it's actually sort of one of the closest things you've seen to ours, really, where it's the people who listen. They don't just like, oh, I'll listen to that every now and again, you know what I mean? You proper feel part of it, really. I know you passed 8,000 Patreon this month, which is like a phenomenal effort, sort of well into that, but it just shows that people don't, it's not just something they listen to, it's something they feel part of, really, and almost sort of celebrating in the success of it, like they're part of it as well.
Yeah, I think especially the Patreons, who obviously they're paying for bonus content. Essentially, they're getting all the stuff we put behind the paywall. They really, really, really feel like they're part of the team, and we're very conscious of that. And like, we want them to feel that way. Do you know what I mean? But like, I've seen like, there's a couple of girls who follow us who get a bit of shit online, and then literally the entire like community that we've built will literally get behind them and get rid of these trolls for them. And like, there was a lad the other day who deleted his account because he called one of our listeners fat or something. And literally about 200 other Patreons are like, right, let's go after him. And it's become this little, it's almost like an antibody. Like, you can't attack that cell, get rid of it. Like, it's really, because they've all got WhatsApp groups.
Yeah.
The listeners have got WhatsApp groups and like Facebook groups that we haven't set up. And they're all just talking and helping each other and doing whatever. So yeah, it's community is definitely the right word, and they definitely sort of feel like, I've had messages about, like, obviously you mentioned before, we'll talk about Live at the Apollo. I've had messages from people who are podcast listeners going, I genuinely felt like proud of you. Like, I've listened to you for over a year on the podcast, and I got a sense of pride watching you. I wasn't even laughing. I was just smiling. Which I don't think is the compliment they think.
They never come to one of my gigs.
Just a room full of people smiling at me for an hour. Community is the right word. And a lot of them genuinely feel like family. They feel like they're part of our family. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Again, it's a weird dynamic for us because, again, when you boiled it down, we're sat in a cupboard in Runcorn and we're not listening. What's quite strange is if I'm in town with me missus, they all know her name because I've mentioned it on the podcast.
Yeah.
Someone will make a beeline. I'll be walking down like Church Street or Lord Street in town, and I can see it from 100 yards away. I know it's coming. Someone will make a beeline for me, and they'll come over and go, oh, lad, love the pot. And then they'll address me missus by name. and it freaks her out. She's another step removed from it. I don't, like, people talk to me like they know me who listen to the podcast, because in a way they do. They know me better than my dad does. The things I've said on that podcast, the details of my life that I've revealed, like, they've got a proper inside track on who I am. But we don't know them. We're not listening to them for 4 hours a week. Hmm. And it gives every conversation and meeting with a random new guy such a strange power dynamic. Because, like, this guy knows everything I've ever said online. I've got it myself. And I don't even know this guy's name. But they'll shout your first name from across the street. It's very, very odd getting used to it. And especially because I think a lot of podcasts do develop that relationship with the listeners. It takes 4, 5, 6 years, and it's a slow build-up. It have a weird sort of being an explosion over the period of 18 months.
Yeah. No, absolutely. No, I recognize a lot of that. It's funny when you say about the community and then do stuff on their own. Like, we started doing, like, these drinks for subscribers where we'd arrange it. Everyone come meet here and have a pint and all this. Now they just do it on their own and don't even invite us. It's like, oh, you know, got together at the pint. Oh, yeah, no. Don't worry about me. Yeah, I was busy anyway. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you just swerved us now and all just hang out together. But no, it's fair enough. Okay, you mentioned Live at the Apollo. I want to talk about that because I know it was a big deal for you, mate. I saw you tweeting that, you know, it's a show you watched. It's a show you thought, one day I want to be on that stage. Yeah. And it happened for you. And the reaction's been brilliant. You must be made up.
I'm delighted with it, to be honest with you. Yeah, so I was getting to a point where I was like, this isn't going to happen because, like, full disclosure, I was sort of quietly informed that I was going to do Live at the Apollo in 2020, right? So the people who make it, they'd been to see me a few times and they'd said, we want Adam. That was in 2019. They were like, we want Adam, but not until 2020. That's when we're going to put him on. So I was like, right, sort of not contracted, can't tell anyone, but I know that's coming. I've been sort of given the little quiet whisper. Guess it's 2020, pandemic cancels everything. I was like, right, that's that gone. And then there was conversations in the comedy community, like, is this show even ever going to come back? Then they say it's coming back. I get a phone call from the agent going, Live the Apollo's coming back and you are in the running, but you need to be seen in London by the guy who runs it next week. Can you be down in London next week? And I was like, absolutely sound. So that was the end of July. I was meant to be going down to London to be seen. That was on the Thursday. On the Tuesday morning, I tested positive for COVID. Now, that was the end of July. They were filming the Apollo in September. So I'm like, there's no chance for him to see me. It's just not going to happen. Ring me agent and he's like, well, look, we'll try and get it for in 11 days when your isolation's up. And we got a date booked in for like 12 days after I'd tested positive. So I was like, right, okay, I'll go down to London for that. And then just very, very luckily, I was very fortunate. I got a phone call while I was still sick saying he doesn't need to see you. He's seen enough a couple of years ago and you're going to be doing it. But he's still going to come and see you in London and he wants you to do the set you're going to do. And then we got to do it. I took, do you know what I found quite weird, right? I'm a big sort of bucket list guy. I like ticking things off my list. I like saying, oh, I got to do that and I got to do this. And it's just a big thing for me. And I like taking the people in my life with me.
Yeah.
So Live at the Apollo has been such a dream for me since I was like literally a kid. I've always wanted to do comedy, right? So I took me missus, me dad, me best mate, another really close mate of mine and his missus, me cousin and her fella. And there was like a load of comedians who were coming because they knew I was on, right? So there's a picture of us on Instagram. There's like 20 of us in the bar afterwards, just getting a picture. Everyone else on the bill. I was like, oh, who have you got in? And like, no one. they all live in London as well. I was the only comic on the bill who doesn't live in London. I paid for everyone's, I basically made no money from doing Live at the Apollo. Paid for everyone's train, paid for everyone's ale all night. I took everyone with me. It just seemed like a big bucket list thing that you want to share with like your closest people. Do you know what I mean? And I had to go on last on the record. So they record two episodes of Live at the Apollo on the same night with the same audience. So the first three acts you see, they all go on together. Then you have a break, and then next week's episode is the three of us. And I was on very, very last for the whole night. And I'm quite provocative on stage. Do you know what I mean? Like I like, so my favorite thing to do on stage with comedy is to wind up both sides of the same argument. So like I'm doing a routine at the minute about like pro-vax and anti-vax people, and how people on the extreme ends of both sides are idiots. because it's just funny to me to try and wind everyone up, right? And there's a routine I've done a few years ago, and I had retired it, to be honest with you. It's the one they ended up broadcasting, which was about Victoria's Secret.
Yeah, it's on social as well, isn't it? People might have seen it clipped. It's really, really good.
Victoria's Secret said they'll never have a fat or a trans model. So I was like, how can I put myself right in the middle of that argument and piss off people who are genuinely fat-phobic and transphobic and piss off like people who are extreme, like, you can't joke about anything. And I managed to do that. But I was watching everyone else on the night of the Apollo. You got to remember, I'm sixth of six acts. And every other act that went on was like uber right on woke, which is fine. And I'm not against that at all. Do whatever you want to do. But the audience were lapping it up. And I'm stood at the side of the stage with another guy who works in comedy. And he was like, what set are you doing? Because he knows me. And I was like, I'm going to do me docs a bit. And then I'm going to do me Victoria's Secret. He's like, they're clapping the exact opposite of your Victoria's Secret routine up there. They're clapping the antithesis of what you're about to do. And I was like, yeah, but this is a proper litmus test, isn't it? I should be able to get that. The joke should stand up. And very, very luckily, it did. And it's come out really well. I was nervous as hell because I've never given a production company my set.
Yeah.
Go on, edit that for a BBC audience. I didn't know what they were going to take out, what they were going to leave in. But as you said, I've been very lucky, and the response to it has been great.
What's been really nice as well online, and I don't really just remember this, I wasn't necessarily going to talk about it. You talk about the Victoria's Secret joke, and I've seen trans people come back to you and say, like, this is how you do it. This is how you make jokes, you know what I mean, around trans issues. I was going to say about trans people. It's not a joke about trans people. You know, people say, yeah, listen to it, make your own decisions. I'd imagine you would laugh along. But that was really nice. And I'm sure you've seen that as well. Trans people come to you and say, like, nice one for this. This is how you make jokes in our area that are funny.
Yeah, that's exactly what you want. On the night it aired, there was literally one or two tweets from not trans people, or maybe there was one trans person, but a couple of people who fight that fight.
Yeah.
Going, oh no, this is not okay. But there was so many more from the trans community going, this is great. And the problem with, like, there's a big civil war going on in comedy at the minute, I suppose, between what you can say and what you can't say. And I like to, again, piss off both sides of that argument. Because if you're on the extreme end of any argument, I think you always sound stupid. The answer's always in the grey area. The answer's always in the middle. And the reason I've still done that routine, I recorded a podcast a while back called The Comedian's Comedian Podcast, hosted by Stuart Goldsmith. And if anyone listening to this is properly interested in the mechanics that go into stand-up and writing it, that's what his podcast is. And we've talked at length about that routine. And I was like, when a trans person comes up to you after the show and you've made jokes about trans people or around their issues and goes, like, one person in Manchester said, thank you for making me feel normal. So many people are worried about upsetting us, and they don't realise we've got some of the best sense of humour in the world. And then people will counter talking about that by pointing out the one person who's complained and go, well, what about this person's feelings? It's like, well, there's going to be overly sensitive people in every demographic.
Yeah.
Like, the straight white men who get offended on their own behalf because things are too, like, there's people replying to that. I put that clip on socials. There's men replying going, you can identify as whatever you like. It doesn't make it the case. You were born as this. And I was like, why do you care? You sad old man. People do whatever they want. It's not your body. It's not your part.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Shut up. People are always going to get upset. And once you realize that and you give a lot more weight to the people your comedy is helping them make laugh, then everything's sound.
Absolutely. Adam, you've got a tour next year, just to sort of finish up on that. It's quite a long one. Finishing in the Philharmonic Hall, which is very cool. A few of the shows have sold out already, which is pretty cool, but most of them still get tickets for. So if people want to come and check it out up and down the country, where's the best place to see the tour dates? I can't possibly read them all out, mate, there's too many. But where can people get them, and where can people get tickets?
Yeah, so if you go to adamrowe.co.uk/shows, the full list is there. If you do check and it says sold out at the minute, send me a message because we are still working on adding some dates. As you say, at the minute, the last days is Friday, the 27th of May in the Philharmonic Hall, which is the night before the Champions League final. I am working on adding a second Liverpool date because at the minute, the only tickets left are up in the gods, and I'm getting a lot of messages from people going, I don't want to sit up there. I want to be in the stalls. what I would say is the Philharmonic Hall, they're all great seats.
Yeah.
So, if you do want to come to that night, go and get the tickets there now. But yeah, as I say, if where you're from is sold out, like Chester, I think all four are sold out now, message me because I am working on adding extra dates if and when I can.
Oh man, Adam, made up to see how well you're doing. Nice one for coming on. And next time we'll try and do this in person. Eh?
Absolutely, mate, yeah.
Cheers, Tom, man.
Having us, lads.
It's still John Gibbons from the Anfield Rap. I just want to let everyone know that there's currently a sale on for all our merchandise on our shop. Now, you might not even know we sell merchandise, but we do. If you go to theanfieldrap.com/shop, there's lots of fantastic stuff all done by designers based here in Liverpool. Printed in Merseyside as well. Wild Tank up in Bootle, who do an amazing job. And yeah, it's yours at the moment for 25% off absolutely everything. So everything on our store, even sale items. So if you go to our sale, there's t-shirts at the moment from only £2 and you can get stuck in there and with an extra 25% off those and all our full price stuff as well, all our newest stuff. We got player stuff, we got stuff to do with the Anfield Rap, stuff to do with the Reds just generally being boss. Some really good designs on t-shirts, hats, we got face coverings, prints as well, and loads of other things in between. So if you go on and get yourself over theanfieldrap.com/shop, and as I say, it's 25% off everything. Just put in the code TAW25 at the end when you're paying. So TAW25 right at the end and get yourself a bargain. Get yourself over there. As I say, some brilliant stuff, and it's all on offer at the moment until the end of the month. We're doing a bit of a theme at the moment around 10 years of tour. It is John Gibbons, and I'm joined by Rob Gutman to talk about his experiences. Just before we do, if you haven't seen already, we did a series of videos of these, which we put out for subscribers in the summer, and then have been going out for free on our YouTube over the last few days or so. So me talking to Mr. Neil Atkinson for half an hour about showing him some images of past times at the Anfield Rap. It was out today. We've also already put out the ones with Gareth and Josh, and over the next few days, we've got Craig and Andy as well. We also did a little bit in the summer where we spoke to Ian Maloney, who was one of the founding members and shareholders of the Anfield Rap. And now I have another one, Mr. Rob Gutman. So Rob, thanks very much for coming and sharing today.
The least I could do, John, after 10 wonderful years with you.
Well, I mean, with each other, I would say, Rob, but let's go back to that very first podcast, because you were on the first one. Quite a few familiar faces on there. Mr. Gerling, who made a bit of a reappearance recently. Neil, obviously, being that very first host. So I'm interested in what you remember about basically being asked to do it and what you understood what you've been asked to do.
Yeah, I mean, it was something that... I felt like Andy was pecking my head about for like 2 years before. We'd have a little bevy and he'd be talking about the idea. Like you are when you're having a bevy, you're half listening to what your mates are saying, but maybe you want to get out what you want to talk about. Do you know what I mean? But I was aware that Andy had this project brewing. And me and Andy and Neil and you as well, obviously, and quite a few of us, have been on a forum, hadn't we? A Liverpool chat forum thing for years. And there'd been a bit of a podcast come out of that, I think.
Yeah, there was. I remember doing it.
I'd never done that, but I know Neil had done it, and I think Andy had been suitably impressed by Neil's efforts there. And I got brought into it as well. I mean, I couldn't remember having said yes to Andy that I would do it. Before I knew, he went, well, we're in the studio in 2 days' time, then you're doing it. Is that okay? Like you said you would. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then suddenly there we were. You know, in a circle of chairs, in a funny sort of recording studio, really looking back on it, and talking shit about Liverpool. And from the moment we first did it, I think I can speak for most people who continue to do it, like you and me and Neil, it just felt the most normal thing in the world to be doing. I never, and I still don't ever have an awareness of there being an audience while I'm doing it. Do you know what I mean? You put me on a stage, like when we've done Anthro Rap Live things, I'm very aware, right? They are there, and I find it slightly nerve-wracking, if I'm honest, and I like to be suitably oiled to do that. But in front of a microphone, it just feels what we do normally. So it's just a continuation of what we're doing down the pub. That was always the aim, that it would be like that, but... it felt fairly easy to be, let's call it, authentic to that, in that sense.
Yeah, no, I think that is right. And I think, you know, for all of us, you know, being conscious a little bit of the audience, like you want it to be good, but also not conscious enough to sort of change how you behave around each other has always been a sort of a key thing, really. And you were a bit of a stalwart, you know, in those early years, you know, Mondays, you know, in the big room where there'd be, you know,
anything up to 8 or 9 some weeks, but you know, at least sort of 6. You felt like you with your big T was always there.
I was there with my big T. No, yeah, I had a near residency. I remember, I think I did probably the first. Feels like I did the first dozen, and then Neil dropped me for one, just for variation's sake. And I remember thinking, I don't know where this is going to go. But no, I mean, I did do the vast majority of them, I felt it in that era. But it was grafting. Although I'm saying, you know, I said we did all enjoy it, and it was great fun to be in. It's quite exciting to be part of, you know, those early days when people like Rafa made a surprise appearance. It would feel like we were at the start of something. But it was also a bit of grafting, as much as there was a lot of bodies in the room, wasn't there?
That's, yeah.
As you said, 8 and 9 is not an exaggeration at times. I remember we get us getting a few complaints early on about some of us interrupting more than others. I think I was probably guilty of that. But you kind of had to. You had to fight to say, it really was a, if you're there, you're there, you know? And you wanted to have your say. So it was a bit of a battle to you know, to get your opinion in. And it was very, it's different to now. People don't really readily interrupt each other anymore, because you don't need to, because there's 3 or 4 of you. The host is sort of got an easier job, in a sense, than Neil had then. And you go, it's your turn. And everyone was a bit more relaxed. But then, there was, you know, it was quite a nerve-wracking thing in that sense.
You mentioned there the host, and obviously you've become one of our top hosts. Do you remember sort of wanting to have a go at that? You know, sort of why that was, really? Because, you know, obviously I know everyone associates you with the shows that you do now. But, you know, I guess at one point there must have been a bit of a, you know, yeah, I'll have a go at this.
Kind of, yeah, you make me think, how did that evolve? I think it evolved from thinking, once you get in, look, there's no doubt, there's no hiding this, right? No saying without it sounding vain or narcissistic. But once you get used to being in that environment, the podcasting environment, and liking the sound of your own voice, which nobody thinks they do, but it's not liking the sound of your own voice. It's enjoying getting the chance to express your opinions, right? Enjoying that. And actually, then when you realize there's an audience for it, you kind of just want to do it more. Maybe it's just a bit addictive. So when I ended up speaking, mainly sort of over pints with Neil, I think, not uniquely, but mainly about how this could be a much bigger thing than just this one or one and a half shows, and we could do lots of them. You know, I wasn't shy about putting my hand up and saying, you know, I could do a show, maybe, Neil. I could host a show, maybe, could I, Neil? And Neil went, maybe you could. And I sort of, you know, politely put him under pressure to do it. And I can't remember the first one I think I pitched that was going to be my show was the Anfield Rap Unwrapped. And the main concept of the show was it being called Unwrapped. I mean, that was as much as I had with that show. And it'd be like the Anfield Rap, but it'd be Unwrapped, right? It really did have not much more substance, but it sort of gave us a license to have a bit of a more magazine format and cover off the stuff that we weren't covering off, I think, in the main shows, which were very about the match that had just been played, was about to be played. So that was good. And then I don't know how the gutter came about, really. I think just people started taking the piss out of me. I remember the name, The Gutter, got agreed on without my knowledge. People thought, let's have a laugh at Rob's name. It doesn't bear too much close examination, that, by the way. It never has done. But it's fine. And people got into it. And so, that, yeah, I have to say that's been a fun journey.
Yeah. You mentioned the idea of turning from one and a half shows into many more. And I don't know if people realize sort of how instrumental you were of that, really. You've always encouraged the Ampio Raph to be ambitious. You were, it's fair to say, risk taker in your professional life away from this, and have encouraged us to sort of be similar. And I don't know how much you remember of those period in 2014. We'd done the magazine, it hadn't worked. And as far as I remember, you and Neil sort of got together to say, well, hang on, what can we do? And would they like podcasts? Let's give them more. And the idea of Tour Player, in my memory, was very much the child of you and Neil, with your sort of, you know, ambition and well, why not, and Neil's brain and you know, creativity, and together sort of Tour Player was born. Is that accurate, would you say?
Yeah, but could I have the brain, though?
I mean, there's two very sizable brains.
I want the brain and the creative. I want all the good ones.
So Neil was just there. Neil went the bar.
No, the Neil's one actually made any, the things happen. No, but let's not, you know, it's Andy's baby. And but you know, there were chats which I think me and Neil had about which did help and give it another lease of life or another dimension. And you know, I think the whole process has been, I think we can all feel pleased with how it's all evolved. I think I would like, well, I was going to say my partner is maybe as you said, sort of encouraging sets, you know, testing all of you to be a bit more ambitious, but I wasn't the doer. You were the doer, John. You and Neil and Gareth and Andy in particular, you know, all you four were the doers who had to make it happen. I mean, I have my day job. I can't hide from that fact. And it always has taken up a lot of my time to varying degrees. I always wanted to give Anfield up as much time as I can, really. It's just not always possible. But I do like being listened to. It's always nice. And it's nice that what was like the germs of ideas did come to fruition. And would you say they exceeded our wildest expectations? I think I think that's fair to say. I mean, obviously, the phase one, two of the project that Andy pioneered wildly exceeded, I think, outsiders' ambitions. I don't know, Andy would have to answer whether it exceeded his ambition. The next phase, I remember a sobering thing. I think we needed a certain number of subscribers to make it a living for the core employees, didn't we? And that was a nervous time, I think, as to whether this just was pie in the sky. Okay, it wasn't going to be my livelihood, but I did take a great sense of responsibility that I've been part of the process of leading people down a path, which is really important. I mean, you, John, you gave up your old job, didn't you?
Yeah.
Your life. You know, that was brave. And not foolhardy as it proved, but it definitely, I think, were you nervous then? Can I throw this back at you in that
space? I was. Do you know what, Rob? I was always confident I could scratch a living, basically. Yeah. So there was always that. There was always, well, if this doesn't work, or even if it just works a bit, then there'll be other stuff. So I was obviously much more involved in music at the time than it was. You know, we were doing some stuff together, weren't we? Yeah, we were social and things, and you know, I was playing and I had a couple of other things. I was doing bits with marketing agencies at the time, and I knew I could do a little bit more. So you know, although it felt like a risk, it was sort of a calculated one in that I was confident with the rap, but also I thought, well, even if I could just get a few quid from that for a while, then I'll top it up with a few more other stuff, and you know, I can always, you know, get the decks out and go and DJ somewhere to pay for me shopping. And so that was sort of, but you know, you talk about exceeding expectations, you know, very quickly. You know, it appeared that I wasn't going to be able to do as much as freelance marketing than what I expected to, which was great. You know, I just wanted to do fuzzy stuff, and that very quickly became apparent that that's all I was going to be doing.
Yeah. I mean, funny, as we're recording this, is the day after Liverpool have been beaten by Leicester, but it was another away trip. Were you at the game, Johnny?
I didn't go, no.
No, you didn't. But you know, if you're you're a regular away goer like me. I'd always enjoyed the away experience on every single level. You enjoy the concourse and you enjoy seeing your mates and you know the bonhomie and the camaraderie that comes with that side of following Liverpool is great. But the Anfield rap has given it another level, really, I would say, because people recognise us. And that's never not nice. Do you know what I mean? It's always nice. It's always nice when people go, and they're always nice as well. I mean, maybe people who are actually famous say this. Maybe they don't say this, but I always like when people let on and go, all right, Rob, it's great, nice one, keep it up. You know, and they do stuff like that. That's just so boss, that. It's,
yeah. One of my,
you know, I've had a relatively long life and a career. You know, I think I've done a lot of my job quite well at times. I've never been praised for it the way I've been praised for the Anfield rap. It's a genuinely gratifying body of work, I think, for all of us who are involved.
Yeah, no, that's completely right. And I think, you know, it's an interesting one, I guess, for you sort of professionally, as you say, because a lot of your work has been, you know, I guess behind the scenes, really, and you've been the person sort of making things happen, and you're not sort of one of these who throws yourself, you know, you know your name out with bars like sort of some people do in the city, and you know what, good luck to them. Ooh. So I guess you know it must be quite a switch for you to be very much the man behind the scenes to suddenly, you know, the man with the microphone making people laugh.
It is nice, as I said. Yeah, it is nice. It's nice for people to, I don't know, I haven't got really any great insight into it, other than it's nice when people seem to like you. You know, it's nice to be like, you hope they're getting who you are, and it's, you know, I don't know, you know what it's like, you play things for laughs a bit. whether people think you're, I don't know, a bit of a giddy idiot at times. I do have that slight insecurity. You go, no, I'm not that. But, you know, I don't know. Do you know what? It's nice to be liked, isn't it?
No, it is. How do you sort of reflect on it all then, sort of 10 years on, in terms of your experiences, in terms of what the rap's done, and I guess what we've all achieved together?
That's a big question, isn't it?
I know.
I think I'm allowed to be feel slightly, because I'm the eldest, aren't I, really, of the long-termers. Yeah, I am. There's the likes of Ian Salmon, who are a couple of years older, but there are probably of us who are the most regular contributors. So I'm allowing myself to feel a bit fatherly towards the project in a certain way. And in that sense, I think I'm allowed to say I'm very proud of everyone involved. And, you know, a lot of you were quite young when you started out. Oh, you were a young boy then, weren't you? You were in your 20s. You were younger than me. You know, I think I was already 40. Yeah, when did we start? 2000. Yeah, so I'd already seen 40, right? So I felt I'm not the grown up in the room. I've never been a grown up in any room I've ever been in. but I was older, and I was with a lot of kids who were starting out. You know, Andy had been discontented with the sort of on and off jobs he'd had. I think Neil was the same, really. He would say the same. And a wide array, I think everyone could say to a degree that they weren't really on their trajectory that they'd seen they were going to end up on before the Anfield rap. And to see people grow, you know, the core founders, and then there's the second wave of young people like Josh and Fuad and Craig. We can't, Craig is young, even
just, you know, about.
I'm made up and proud to see those journeys that all these people have gone on, and see them, you know, get to a place where they're really respected and have really contributed towards something that's quite fantastic, I think, quietly.
Well, thanks for all your help, Rob, and this is from a personal point of view. Thanks for how much you've helped me. You know, you mentioned us being young. There's very little business acumen in the Anfield at the start. Shout out to Wayne Scholes, obviously, from Red Touch Media, who's our investor, who helps a lot, but has a lot of other investments in other places and literally lives out in America. But Wayne's obviously been a huge help. But Rob, just having someone, and I'm trying to say occasionally you are in the grown up in the room, mate, but we very much appreciate it. So nice one to you. Any sort of particular highlights jump out before we finish? You know, you mentioned Rafa. That must have been quite a cool thing. You know, you told him that your son was named after him, which is quite a sort of mad thing. Do you want to talk about that or any others that sort of jump out before we finish?
I think he was suitably underwhelmed. I had the same reaction once. No, never mind. It's another story. I met Debbie Harry, one of my all-time heroes. She was also underwhelmed by my tribute to her. What stood out? I don't know. I suppose the memories that sort of burn brightest are those in the earliest days and all sorts of mad rooms we were in. I've got this really vivid memory of us doing a show in a basement. Were you on it, John? Somewhere in North Liverpool, and we were eating crisps and getting hammered. Do you remember that?
No.
I don't remember it. We got a load of... We were very sensitive, especially in those days, to sort of, like, I think a number of sort of forums would comment on what we were doing. We were kind of annoyed them eating crisps on the microphones. I thought, fucking hell. Well, it made me sort of think, is this more serious than I'm taking this? You know what I mean? So that's not an amazing memory, but it's just something that stands out for me.
Oh, I know you mean, with the realisation that there's lots of people out there. Rob, Tom, man, thanks so much for coming on and sharing. I really appreciate it.
But if you've stayed with us all the way through live, we're back. It is Neil Atkinson with Stu Wright, with Andy McCann and with Steve Evans to talk about now looking ahead to the Chelsea game. Now, we're not going to do much on this because Chelsea have not played Brighton at the time at which we're talking to one another. The one thing we can say, Steve, and we can say it with absolute certainty, is it's become must win. You know, it's City will absolutely bounce into Brentford tonight. For me, there's a comparison in 1920, and Stu's right before not to hark back to it, but in 1920, Liverpool go to Leicester and they win 4-0. The following night, City drop points against Wolverhampton Wanderers after having seen Liverpool be that impressive. I think those City players will almost feel like they've won. Not won against Brentford, but they won the game last night. They will bounce into Brentford full of adrenaline, knowing what putting three more points on the board will mean. I think they roll Brentford tonight. We cannot drop points at Stamford Bridge.
100%. It's season, I mean, not the season defining, because I think even if we go there and win, we still might not be enough. But we've got to give ourselves some hope by going in and getting results. And and going there and putting on a performance that shows that, we can win this league title. It's either that or we just go for the, we sit back and we try a few different things and just ensure top four and go for the Champions League, which is not what we want to do. So it's vital that we go there and try and get, turn over a very, very good Chelsea side. There's some changes that definitely I would make. I think the front three needs freshening up a little bit. Maybe he'll hop back to what he played at Man United away. You think you might see Mane drop out. I think he might need a little bit of rest or give us something different up the top there. But we need to go there, come out all guns blazing and put on a real show at Stamford Bridge and hopefully get 3 points and put us back in the title race.
It is a must-win to think about our team for a second, Andy. I think that Steve might have a point there. It wouldn't surprise me to see Mane from the bench on this one. It also wouldn't surprise me to see if there's any way he gets Thiago back in, he gets Thiago back in. I wouldn't be surprised to see Keita start alongside Thiago and Fabinho in there as well. He's got a little question, I'd say, about who starts next to Van Dijk. And the other thing I will point out from the Leicester game and in general, we've maybe got to be a little bit conscious that earlier in the season it didn't look like this was the case, but right now there is a drop-off between Robertson and Tsimikas.
Yeah, I think based on last night, the who starts with Matip. I know that's a bit daft because obviously Van Dijk, but for me that's not a question, even though Canate's done well. I think there's as many flaws in Van Dijk at the minute as there is any of the others, certainly his partners, but I think he brings an air of calmness. But I agree with, I'd be reluctant, even though I've just kind of singled him out for being off it last night. Unless there's an injury, I think I'd be reluctant to go to Chelsea away without Henderson playing in a midfield three. I think Thiago coming back into that would be essential. And I think I wholeheartedly agree on Firmino coming back in, because I think what Firmino will give you that none of the others give you is the pressing in the kind of the deep lying area with, obviously, Kovacic, who's back to fitness now, will possibly start. But Jorginho is their main man. I think he keeps them ticking over. He's been fundamental to everything they've won over the last few years. Yeah. And I think Firmino is probably the best forward in the world at doing that, covering in deep areas. So I think he'll definitely come in, even if it's just for that. And then what you often find when Firmino plays is Mane and Salah in the wide areas play better. And I think that the change that Steve referenced about Jota coming in, even though he's been brilliant and hit the ground running, I think he changes the dynamic of the front three. And the argument, certainly based on last night, is potentially negatively changes the whole dynamic, even though he's individually contributing. So I think Firmino coming in may give you that back. And then Jota, I would go Jota left. Obviously, you stay with Salah, but then Firmino in. And I think if Thiago's muscle strain, which Klopp referred to it last night, is just a very slight muscle strain, it's nothing too serious, I'd be bringing him straight back in, yeah. And I think him taking Firmino off last night is evident that he's definitely going to start as well, which I think we all would anyway. But the fact he took him off before he got booked, he's a guaranteed starter.
You'd think so, Stu. You'd think so. It's all on the line, isn't it? It is a massive game on Sunday. You can't actually talk it up enough now, I don't think, what's on the horizon there on Sunday. Obviously, we've got to get the other side of their game tonight and see what shape they look like there in Chelsea. But it is absolutely must win.
Yeah, I hate games like this, because if you win it, we'll have gone to Stamford Bridge, we'll have won, and it'll feel great and everything like that. But all you get out of it is that you're still in the mix, and you're still potentially 6 points behind. Whereas if you lose, it's game over. We go there and we get beat, forget it.
It's like a final, but without the trophy.
Yeah. And so it's an unfair balance, I think, in terms of my enjoyment, my entertainment for Sunday afternoon, really. I think Andy's right in the shout for Jota being on the left. I like the idea of his unpredictability from that position. I think that'll be needed. I'd definitely be bringing Bobby back in. Much the same as shouts as have been said all around, really. I think, the more often that we can get our preferred midfield three, which I think we all agree is Henderson, Thiago and Fabinho in there, the better it's going to be for us. But I think it's a really tough one to call, this really tough one. I just hope that actually what makes the difference is the fact that we just got beat. And Liverpool then actually, you know, put the shoulders back, heads up, and really put on a great performance, a kind of performance where, you know, whatever happens, we are not getting beat. No way. And, you know, Liverpool have shown in the past that they can go that way. But there's also a flip side to that coin where, you know, that little loss of momentum could carry over to another game. So I think it's so tough to call when the stakes are this high and the level of competition against Chelsea is also so high.
They're a good side, Steve. They're as good as us so far this campaign at the halfway mark in terms of points on the board. The one thing I'd say is I think they've caught moments of luck in maybe a way in which we haven't. Brentford away being a very good example of one where they don't deserve to get out with anything, and they do. They get out with all 3 points. I think if there's a game where I'd quite like Liverpool to not just be good but also be lucky, it is Sundays at Stamford Bridge. We could also do with the referee who's worth a carrot.
Yeah, Christ. Do they exist? Yeah, it's, you know, Chelsea have ever thought they'd run away with the start of the season, the way they started, you know, they started this campaign very, very well. Some, you know, some very good performances with scattered bits of luck, as you say. There were games that they got away with a little bit. I've relied a lot on goals from centre-half and defenders, full-backs, but Lukaku's back now, seems to have recovered from his ankle injury and COVID, so he will be a threat. They're a very good side, and if we go there with anything less than our very best, then we'll get rolled. And if we do that, then it's going to be a long fucking January with ever going to AFCON as well. So it's vital that we go there with a reaction. And the good thing about this club side is they usually do bring a reaction with them after a bad performance. So.
Manager was emphatic as well, wasn't he, after the game, Steve, that it wasn't acceptable in a way he often isn't.
Yeah, an absolute demand. He will have them. He will be up their arses to speak big time, get them to demand a performance from them at Stamford Bridge New Year's Day. So it's massively important we go there and do it.
Give me a prediction, Steve.
2-1.
Liverpool.
Of course.
Stuart. You're on mute. Come on, mate.
3-1
Liverpool.
3-1 Liverpool. I'm all on the back of, I think Steve's just persuaded me over the how Klopp was after the game, really. I think that might be the difference maker.
Okay, Andy.
My prediction, Neil, and it might be because I've just come out of an 8 or 9 day isolation period having COVID over Christmas and I'm looking for anything positive, is, you know what? It's not that bad. We've played 19, we've lost 2, City have lost 2. So they're not, the 6 points ahead of us, the 3 draws they've had, the 3 draws we've had are the 6 points difference. We repeat what we've done over the next 19, but we beat them, cancel out a couple of draws, and, you know, number 20 is coming home. And it starts on Sunday, Neil, with a 3-1 win. Salah showing why he's back to his best, and Mane coming off the bench just to rectify the Leicester win. There you go. There's my post-COVID bit of cheer for you, Neil.
A wonderful cheer, honestly. Absolutely wonderful cheer. I might have to walk around with me for the next 3 days, to be honest with you, Andy. Like a chirpy St. Bernard.
I'm out at midnight, mate, wherever you want to meet. Let's do it. I'm out at midnight. I'm up for it.
Me and McCann, El Bandito, talking the Reds up midnight tonight. See you in there. Be live. There or be square. Tour Midnight Live, like Hollyoaks over Dart, but a lot less sexy. Thank you very much indeed, too. And trust me, that's a low bar to not clear. Thank you very much indeed to Steve Evans, to Stu Wright, to Andy McCann, also to John Gibbons, Rob Gutman, and Adam Rowe for all taking the time. No thanks to the mighty boys in Red, but if Andy McCann's right, we'll have so much to thank them for on Monday. We won't even know where to start. This league is not going to win itself, but Liverpool have got to make sure they do not lose it cheap.
Sports Social Podcast Network.